Tim Huntley said. He'd come round the corner of the Dutch barn, and a movement had caught his eyes. It was someone on top of the 20-foot-high maize stack, someone not very big. And then the someone had moved again and revealed itself to be the kid from what Tim and his mother called No Hope Cottage.
"Hey!" Tim said again. "What are you doing up there?"
"Nothing," Rory said. He looked blue with cold.
"You better come down."
Rory hesitated. Tim moved to stand directly below him.
"I'll catch you."
Rory manoeuvred himself until he was holding on only with his arms.
"Let go."
Rory fell. Tim caught him clumsily around the waist, and they both tumbled to the floor. Rory got to his feet.
"Sorry."
Tim got up slowly.
"So you should be. Why are you here in any case?"
Rory said nothing. He didn't know, except that he'd been driven from the cottage by a sudden desperation, and the farm had seemed a simple destination. Tim looked at him. He was shivering. He hadn't enough flesh on him to keep a sparrow warm.
"I'll take you home."
"No," Rory said.
"Why not? You in trouble?"
"No," Rory said. "You don't need to take me, thanks."
Tim let a pause fall and then said,
"Where's your dad?"
"He's not here. He lives in Sedgbury."
"So your mum's on her own there, with you lot?"
Rory nodded.
"You better ring her," Tim said. "Tell her where you are."
"No."
Rory couldn't explain. He couldn't tell this man he hardly knew that if he rang Nadine there'd be a drama, and she'd insist on coming to get him and on thanking Tim Huntley as if he'd rescued Rory from drowning. He said instead,
"I got bored. I'll go now."
"Home?"
"Yes."
"Mind you do," Tim said.
He remembered Nadine distraught in the dark lane on Christmas Eve. Tim had discussed her and the children at length with his mother.
"You keep an eye," Mrs. Huntley had said.
Tim put a hand into his pocket and found a packet of chewing gum. He held it out to Rory.
"Hop it."
"Thanks."
"I'm going to ring your place dinner time, and if you're not home, you'll cop it."
The letter had come in the post along with the three bills. Matthew had taken the bills very quickly. He didn't want Josie to see how the very sight of a brown envelope alarmed him. He then handed her the letter.
"That's his writing, isn't it?"
It was indeed Tom's writing. "You'd better take it then," Matthew said. She put her hands behind her back.
"I don't want to."
He gave her a glance.
"It might be about Rufus."
"He rings about Rufus. Letters always mean someone is ducking saying something to your face. I'll leave it till later, after the job interview. I'm nervous."
"You'll be great. I'd employ you."
"You're biased," she said. The interview had turned out to be unalarming. The larger of the two primary schools in Sedgbury needed a supply teacher for English and General Studies for 2 terms while the permanent teacher took maternity leave. Escorting her out, the head teacher said, "I'll report to my governess, Mrs. Mitchell, and will let you know as soon as possible." When she got home, the kitchen was just as she had left it, with breakfast cleared away and the table bare except for the letter under the peanut butter jar. When she'd made herself some coffee, she would open it. Outside Rufus's school, several other mothers waited. Rufus was almost always nearly last, walking steadily towards Josie with his head bent. Josie stooped and kissed him. He hadn't told her not to yet, so she thought she would go on until he did.
"Are you hungry?"
"Yes."
"What was lunch?"
Rufus thought.
"Shepherd's pie and spaghetti."
"No vegetables?"
"Carrots, but I didn't eat them."
"Nothing green?"
Rufus shook his head. That had been a relief. In his view, there were peas, which were fine, and then there were vegetables, all of them, which were not fine at all. "Would you like it," Josie said, "if we went and had a burger?" He looked up. "Yes." In the burger bar, Josie said, "Rufus." He looked at her over his cheeseburger. "I've got something to tell you." He stopped chewing. "I had a letter from Daddy this morning." He was watching her, waiting. "Darling, I think Daddy is going to get married again." He regarded her for a moment and then seemed abruptly to relax. He took another bite. "I know," he said, through his mouthful. "Do you?" He nodded. "She was in the house." "After Christmas?" "Yes." Did you like her?" Rufus nodded. "She's called Elizabeth." "What did she look like?" Rufus considered. "A bit like Granny."
"Granny?"
"Not so old," Rufus said, "but kind of not showing off." He looked completely calm, almost, to her dismay, as if this new development was rather welcome. "Don't you mind if Daddy marries someone else?" "No," Rufus said. He gave Josie a sudden sharp look. "Do you?" Josie said confusedly, it just seems a bit quick." "I expect he was lonely," Rufus said. "Just him." "Yes." Rufus took another enormous bite of his burger and said through it, "Elizabeth can ice skate. She said she'd teach me."
"You can't mind," Matthew said.
"What can't I mind?"
"Tom getting married again."
"But I'll have to share Rufus."
"Only occasionally.
He's been mine and only mine all my life. You don't know Elizabeth wants to change that," Matthew said. "You don't even know if she wants him."
He stopped abruptly. Danger zones loomed.
"Why," Josie had said in tears after their disastrous Christmas, "am I supposed to love your children when nobody expects them even to try to love me?"
"Look," Matthew went on, "it's better for everyone. Rufus doesn't have to worry about Tom being lonely, and you don't have to feel guilty about leaving him." He went round the table and kissed her. "It's good news." She looked up at him.
It's just that mother love is such a killer. Father love isn't a picnic either.
Sorry.
At least Rufus lives with you."
"Matt, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said it."
"I've got to go and do some work," Matthew said. "Sorry."
He went and pulled down the ladder that gave access to the roof space. Up there, Matthew had made himself a study. It was the only privacy that 17 Barrett Road afforded. It was a working space, a thinking space. It was also becoming the place where he could think freely about his children. There was normally something constrained in his thinking about them, because—and it was no good attempting to delude himself— Josie couldn't see anything likable, let alone lovable, in any of them. To be sure, they'd given her a relentlessly hard time, but Matthew doubted that Josie had any notion of the degree of loyalty Nadine demanded.
"Stand up to Nadine," Josie had cried on Christmas night. "Why don't you stand up to her?"
He'd been so heartsick and weary that he had briefly wondered why he had started all this. Why he had ever hoped that he could be free of the past.
"Because," he said, "she'd only take it out on the children. Whatever I do, I have to think of whether it'll make it worse for the children."
He sat down at his desk now in front of a patchwork of photographs of his children, taken at all ages, in the bath, by the sea, asleep, in fancy dress. There was one he liked particularly of Rory, in pyjamas and a cowboy hat, holding a cat. His expression was full of protective responsibility. Nadine had rung Matthew several times recently to say that Rory was playing truant.
She'd been, inevitably, loud with reasons for Rory's behaviour, but had refused as yet to allow Matthew to do anything about it.
"Then why ring?"
"Because you're his father."
"When you let me be."
Nadine was refusing to let Rory or his sisters come to Sedgbury. She said she didn't want them disturbed by contact with a stepmother they detested. Matthew's solicitor said he must be patient. Give it a month or two. If you haven't seen the kids by Easter, then we'll start some action.
"I'll sell it," Elizabeth said.
She stood with her arm through Tom's, looking at the house she'd bought only months before. "I'm grateful to it, but it's not going to be my life now." She looked at Tom.
"I suppose Dale wouldn't like it."
"Why do you mention Dale?" Tom asked.
"Because when we met, she told me she hated her flat and that Bath is home, so maybe..."
"I don't think so. Too big, too close," Tom said.
"To us?"
"Yes."
"Come on," Elizabeth said. "We're all grown up, and Dale has her own life, and in any case, she's shown absolutely no resentment towards me at all."
Tom smiled. "Too close for me, then."
"But you love her, dearly."
"What then?" "She has an overwhelming quality, as you'll discover. She can't help needing to be involved. We must start as we mean to go on, which is without Dale 15 minutes' walk away." Later that day, sitting in Tom's kitchen, he said apologetically that he had a client to see.
"I'll only be a couple of hours. Why don't you have a good look at the house? Without me."
When he'd gone, she went out into the narrow hall, elegantly floored in black and white, and began to climb the stairs up to what Tom referred to as the children's rooms. Rufus's room, Dale's room, and the room that had been Lucas's. Lucas had not occupied his room for 6 or 7 years. He had moved out when he went to university. The room felt raw and unused, but it was a pleasant room. It was a room that might in time become a nursery. Elizabeth moved across the landing and turned the handle of Dale's door. It was locked. She turned the handle again and shook it. It was locked most decidedly. The smooth white paint stared back at Elizabeth as if defying her to guess what was beyond it. She put her eye to the keyhole. It was quite black, as if taped up from inside. Nothing could be more plain than that Dale regarded this room as her territory, the place she intended to keep as hers, whatever. Elizabeth stood up. Tom had told her about Dale, about the effect of her mother's death on a personality already volatile and needy, about the scene with Dale hysterical, and Lucas, white-faced with fear and grief, looking on in stunned silence. Elizabeth looked at Dale's locked door and felt, for the first time, a tiny twinge of apprehension.